The sperm is a product which comes from the whole body of each parent. Weak sperm coming from the weak parts and strong sperm from the strong parts. Then he goes ahead and talks about the coagulation of the mother's blood. The seed, embryo, then is contained in the membrane. Moreover, it grows because of its mother's blood, which descends to the womb. For once a woman conceives, she ceases to menstruate. Then about flesh, he says at this stage, with the descent and coagulation of the mother's blood, flesh begins to form, be formed with the umbilicus. And lastly, bones, he says, as the flesh grows, it is formed into distinct members by breath. The bones grow hard and send out branches like a tree. Next, we will look at Aristotle. In his book on the generation of animals, sometime about 350 BC, he gives his stages of embryology. And he talks about first semen and menstrual blood, or catamenia. In this section, Aristotle speaks of the male semen as being in a pure state. It follows that what the female would contribute to the semen of the male would be material for the semen to work on. In other words, the semen clots the menstrual blood. Then he goes to flesh. He says nature forms this from the purest material, the flesh. And from the residue thereof, it forms bones. And lastly, around the bones, and attached to them by thin fibrous bands, grow the fleshly parts. Clearly, the Quran follows this exactly. Sperm clotting the menstrual blood, which forms meat, then the bones are formed, and lastly, around about the bones, grow the fleshly parts. Next, we will consider Indian medicine. The opinion of Charaka in 123 AD and Susruta is that both the male and female contributed seed. The secretion of the male is called the sukra, semen. The secretion of the woman is called artava or sanita, blood, and it is derived from the blood by way of food, by way of blood. Here we see that in the medicine of India, they too had the idea that the child was formed from semen and blood. Now we shall look at Galen. Galen was born in 131 AD in Pergamum, modern Bergama in Turkey. Galen says, on semen, the substance from which the fetus is formed is not merely menstrual blood, as Aristotle maintained, but menstrual blood plus the two semens. The Quran agrees with Galen here when it says in Surah 76:2, "We created man from a drop of mingled sperm." Now we'll look at the Galen stages. Galen also taught that the embryo developed in stages. The first is that in which the form of the semen prevails. The next stage is when it has been filled with blood, and heart and brain and liver are still unarticulated and unshaped. This is the period that Hippocrates called fetus. The Quranic Surah 22:5 reflects this saying, "Then out of a morsel of flesh, partly formed and partly unformed." And now the third period of gestation has come. Nature caused flesh to grow on and around all the bones. We saw above that the Quran agrees with this in Surah 23:14, where it says, "And we clothe the bones with meat." The fourth and final period is at the stage when all the parts of the limbs have been differentiated. Galen was so important in medicine that just about the time of the Hegira, four leading medical men in Alexandria, Egypt, decided to form a medical school using 16 books of Galen as the basis of the studies. This continued up to and including the 13th century. We must now ask ourselves, what was the political, economic, and medical situation in Arabia at the time of Muhammad? From the Hadramaut in Yemen, the caravans of the spice trade passed north through Mecca and Medina and then reached into all of Europe. In North Arabia, in about 500 AD, the Ghassanids took over, and by 528, they controlled the Syrian desert over to the outskirts of Medina. Syriac, a form of Aramaic related to Arabic, was their official language. As early as 463, the Jews translated the Torah and Old Testament from Hebrew into Syriac. The British Museum has a copy. This made it available to the Ghassan, who were Christians, and to the Jewish tribes in Arabia. During this time, Sergius el Rasaini, who died in Constantinople in 536, one of the earliest and greatest translators from Greek into Syriac, translated various works on medicine, including 26 works of Galen. This made them available in the kingdom of Khosrow I in Persia and to the Ghassan tribe, whose influence extended to the outskirts of Medina. Khosrow I, Arabic Kisra, king of Persia, was known as Khosrow the Great. His troops conquered areas as far away as Yemen, and he also loved learning and started several schools. The school of Jundishepur became, during Khosrow I's long reign of 48 years, the greatest intellectual center of the time. Within its walls, Greek, Jewish, Nestorian, Persian, and Hindu thought and experience were freely exchanged. Teaching was done largely in Syriac, from Syriac translations of Greek texts. This meant that Aristotle, Hippocrates, and Galen were readily available when the medical school at Jundishapur was operating during his reign. The next step was that the conquering Arabs compelled the Nestorians to translate their Syriac texts of Greek medicine into Arabic. The translation from Syriac to Arabic was easy, as the two languages had the same grammar. Concerning the local medical situation during Muhammad's life, we know there were physicians living in Arabia during this period. Harith bin Qalada was the best educated physician trained in the healing arts. He was born about the middle of the 6th century at Ta'if in the tribe of Bani Thaqif. He traveled through Yemen and then Persia, where he received his education in the medical sciences at the great medical school of Jundishapur, and thus was intimately acquainted with the medical teachings of Aristotle, Hippocrates, and Galen. Having completed his studies, he practiced as a physician in Persia, and during this time he was called to the court of King Khosrow, with whom he had a long conversation. He came back to Arabia about the beginning of Islam and settled down at Taif. While there, Abu al-Khair, a king of Yemen, came to see him in connection with a certain disease, and on being cured, rewarded him with much money and a slave girl. Though Harith bin Qalada did not write any book on medicine, his views on many medical problems are preserved in his conversation with Khosrow. About the eye, he says that it is constituted of fat, which is the white part. The second is constituted with water, which is the black part, and of wind, which constitutes the eyesight. Well, these things we know to be wrong now, but this was Greek thought. All this goes to show the acquaintance of Harith with the Greek doctors. Summarizing the situation in a few words in his book, Histoire de la Médecine Arabe, Dr. Lucien Leclerc writes, Harith bin Qalada studied medicine at Jundishapur, and Muhammad owed to Harith a part of his medical knowledge. Thus, with the one as well as the other, we easily recognize the traces of Greek medicine. Sometimes Muhammad treated the sick, but in the difficult cases, he would send the patients to Harith. Another educated person around Muhammad was Nadir bin Harith. Not related to the doctor, he was a Qurayshite and cousin of Muhammad, and had also visited the court of Khosrow. He had learned Persian and music, which he introduced among the Quraysh at Mecca. However, he was not sympathetic to Muhammad, mocking some of the stories in the Quran. Muhammad never forgave him for this, and when he was taken prisoner at the Battle of Badr, he caused him to be put to death. In summary, we see that 1. Arabs living in Mecca and Medina in 600 had political and economic relations with people from Ethiopia, Yemen, Persia, and Byzantine. A cousin of Muhammad knew Persian well enough to do his musical studies in it. 3, the Ghassan tribe which ruled the Syrian desert over to the gates of Medina used Syriac. One of the main languages used to teach medicine in Jundishapur is their official language. An ill king of Yemen came to Taif to consult the physician Harith bin Qalada, who had been trained where? At Jundishapur, the best medical school in that world, and to whom Muhammad sometimes sent patients. 5, during Muhammad's lifetime, a new medical school was established in Alexandria, using the 16 books of Galen as their texts. This all shows that there was ample opportunity for Muhammad and the people around him to have heard of the embryological theories of Aristotle, Hippocrates, and Galen when they went to seek treatment from Harith bin Qalada and other local doctors. Thus, when the Quran says in the late Meccan Surah of the Believer, 4067, He it is who created you from dust, then from a sperm drop, then from a leech-like clot, that perhaps you may understand. And then in the Surah of the Pilgrimage, O mankind, if you have doubt about the resurrection, consider what we have created, that we have created you from dust. It is correct for us to ask again, what were they to understand? What were they to consider? And here are the Quranic sages again. Nutfa, sperm. Alaka, clot. Mudagha, piece of meat. Adam, bones. And 5, dressing the bones with muscles. The answer is very clear. They were understanding and considering that which was common knowledge, the embryological stages as taught by the Greek physicians. I don't mean that Muhammad's listeners all knew the names of the Greek physicians, but they knew the embryological stages of the Greek physicians. They believed that the male sperm mixed with the female menstrual blood to cause it to clot, and this became the baby. 2, they believed there was a time when the fetus was formed and unformed. 3, they believed the bones formed first and then were covered with muscle. Allah was using that common knowledge as a sign encouraging the listeners and readers to turn to Him. The trouble is that this common knowledge was and is not true. Arab physicians after Muhammad. We must now look at 2 well-known physicians from the period after Muhammad. Obviously, they had no effect on the Quran, but they demonstrated that faith in the embryological ideas of Aristotle, Hippocrates, and Galen continued among the Arabs right up to the 1600s. If the correct translation of alaka is leech-like substance, as modern Muslims like Shabir Ali claim, there is no place where these post-Quranic doctors said so. In fact, it's just the opposite. The ideas of these Greek physicians were being used to explain the Quran, and the Quran was quoted to enlighten the meaning of the Greek physicians. The human being takes its origin from this is speaking about Ibn Sina or Avicenna. The human being takes its origin from 2 things. The male sperm, which plays the part of factor. The female sperm, first part of the menstrual blood, which provides the matter. Thus we see that Ibn Sina gave the female semen exactly the same role that Aristotle had assigned to the menstrual blood. It is difficult to overstate the importance of Ibn Sina as a scientific and philosophical authority for the pre-modern Europeans. Then we're going to look at Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. Ibn Qayyim took full advantage of the agreement between Quranic revelation and Greek medicine. This is not very clear, probably, but the Hippocrates is in purplish, and the Quran is in bold type, green, and the Hadith is in purple, and commentaries are in red, and his own thoughts in sort of a blue-green. So it starts out, he says, Hippocrates said in the 3rd chapter of Kitab al-Jinnah, al-Jinnah, the semen is contained in a membrane and it grows because of the blood of its mother which descends to the womb. Some membranes are formed at the beginning, others after the 2nd month, and others in the 3rd month. And this phrase about the blood descending to the womb, we saw it when we looked at Hippocrates' slide. That is why God said, here the Quran is mentioned, He creates you in the womb of your mothers by one formation after another in 3 darknesses. That's Quran 39:6. Then he gives his own ideas. Since each of these membranes has its own darkness, when God mentioned the stages of creation and transformation from one state to another, he also mentioned the darknesses of the membranes. Most commentators explain, and here are the words of the commentators, it is the darkness of the belly and the darkness of the womb and the darkness of the placenta. In a second example, we read, Hippocrates said, the mouth opens up spontaneously and the nose and ears are formed from the flesh. The ears are opened and the eyes, which are filled with a clear liquid. The prophet used to say, I worship him who made my face and formed it and opened my hearing and eyesight and so forth. Here we look at Hippocrates again. And there in the second stage is the same thing we just read. Ibn al-Qayyim is quoting Hippocrates and speaks of the mother's blood descends around the membrane. He could do this, as we have seen, because the educated people of Muhammad's time were familiar with Greek medicine. However, what is important for us here today to realize is that there is no place where the Quran corrected Greek medicine. There is no place where Ibn Qayyim was shouting, hey, you guys, you've got it this all wrong. The correct meaning of alaka is that which clings or leech-like substance. On the contrary, Ibn Qayyim was demonstrating the agreement between the Quran and the Greek medicine, their agreement in error. A final witness is the commentary of Baydawi in 1200 A.D. Here we have the commentary, we have the Quran here, we have his commentary, and here it's been translated, and he says, then from alaka, a piece of solid blood is his explanation of alaka. Alaka is underlined, that's from the Quran. And here's his explanation, a piece of solid blood. Then he goes on, then from a piece of meat, from the Quran. A piece of meat originally as much as can be chewed, and so forth. As I mentioned at the beginning of this study, it has been said that the idea of the embryo developing through stages is a modern one, and that the Quran is anticipating modern embryology by depicting differing stages. Yet we have seen that Aristotle, Hippocrates, the Indians, and Galen have all discussed the stages of embryological development during the 1,000 years before the Quran. And after the coming of the Quran, the account of the different stages as described by the Quran and the Greek doctors, was carried on in the teachings of Avicenna and Ibn Qayyim, and is essentially the same as that taught by Galen and those preceding him. Concerning the bone stage, it's clear, as Dr. Moore demonstrated so capably in his textbook, that muscles start forming from the somites at the same time as the cartilage models of the bones. There's no bone stage where there's a skeleton sitting here and then the muscles are plastered around it. It is equally clear that alaka in the Quran means clot, and that the Quraysh who heard Muhammad speaking understood him to be referring to the menstrual blood as the female contribution to the developing baby. Therefore, we can conclude that during all these years, the Quranic verses on embryology, saying that man is created from a drop of sperm which becomes a clot, were in perfect accord with the science of the first century of the Hijra, of the time of the Quran. But when compared with the modern science of the 20th century, Hippocrates is in error, Aristotle is in error, Galen is in error, and the Quran is in error. They are all in serious error. Now we're going to look at a little bit about moonlight. Does the Quran state that the moon gives off reflected light from the sun before this was common knowledge? In the Surah of Noah, 71:15-16, it says, see ye not how Allah has created the seven heavens one above another, and made the moon a light, Noor, in their midst, and made the sun as a lamp, Siraj? The moon is called a light, Arabic Noor. And the sun a lamp, Siraj. Some Muslims claim that since the Quran uses different words speaking from about the light of the sun and the light of the moon, it reveals that the sun is a source of light, while the moon only reflects light. This claim is implied very strongly by Shabir Ali in his booklet Science in the Quran, and stated clearly by Dr. Zakir Naik in his video, Is the Quran God's Word? As you will now see clearly.
The light that we have, the light that we obtain from the moon, where does it come from? He will tell me that previously we thought that the light of the moon was its own light. But today, after science has advanced, we have come to know that the light of the moon is not its own light, but it's a reflected light of the sun. I will ask him a question. That it is mentioned in the Quran, in Surah Al-Furqan, chapter number 25, verse number 61, Blessed is he who has created the constellations and placed therein a lamp and a moon which has reflected light. The Arabic word for moon is Qamar, and the light described there is Munir, which is borrowed light, or Noor, which is a reflection of light. The Quran mentions that the light of the moon is reflected light. You say you discovered it today. How come it's mentioned in the Quran 1400 years ago? We will pause for a time. You won't reply immediately. And then may say, maybe it's a fluke. I don't argue with him. Perfect.
Near the end of the video, we heard Dr. Naik explain the Arabic word for moon is Qamar, and the light described there is Munir, which is borrowed light, or Nur, which is a reflection of light. Please do not forget what he said. Munir is borrowed light, and Nur is reflected light. Not only is this claimed to be a statement in keeping with scientific truth, but it is also claimed to be scientifically miraculous, since this was supposedly only discovered relatively recently. It is correct that the moon does not emit its own light, but only reflects the light of the sun. But this was known already almost 1,000 years before Muhammad. Aristotle, in about 360 BC, discussed knowing that the earth was round by its shadow on the moon. He could only speak of the earth's shadow crossing the moon if he knew that moonlight is reflected light. If you still insist that this is a miracle of scientific knowledge, then we must ask ourselves, do the Quranic words themselves support this claim? Siraj. First we shall look at Siraj. In Surah Noah, which was read above, in Surah Al-Furqan 25:61, it is simply lamp, referring to the sun. In Surah An-Naba 78:13, Sirajan Wahjan means a dazzling lamp, again indicating the sun. The words Nur and Munir come from the same Arabic word. Root. The word Munir is used 6 times in the Quran. 4 times, Surahs Al-Imran 3:184, Al-Hajj 22:8, Luqman 31:20, and Fatir 35:35, it is the phrase Kitab al-Munir, which Yusuf Ali translates as a book of enlightenment, and Pictol uses the scripture giving light. Clearly, this indicates a book which is radiating the light of knowledge. Nothing about reflection. Nur. It says in Surah Noah 71:16 and Yunus 10:5 that Allah made the light, the moon a light. Thus we find that the Quran says that the moon is a light, and it never says that the moon reflects light. Moreover, in other verses, the Quran says that Allah is a Nur, a light. Surah An-Nur 24:35, one of the most beautiful passages in the Quran, reads, Allah is the light, Nur, of the heavens and the earth. The parable of his life is as if there was a niche, and within it a lamp, the lamp enclosed in glass, the glass as it were a brilliant star, and so forth. Thus we see that the word nur is used for both the moon and Allah. Are we going to say that Allah gives off reflected light? I think not. But if you continue to insist that nur, used for the moon, means borrowed or reflected light, and we saw above that Allah is the light, nur, of the heavens and the earth, what is the source of this light, siraj, of which Allah is only a reflection? Think about it. If Allah is named nur, or reflected light, who or what is the siraj? Well, the Quran tells us who the siraj is. But the answer will shock you.